Okay, thank you. Our next presenter is going to be LaWanda Williams. LaWanda is a native Baltimore, Maryland, where she provided medically related case management and counseling services for over 9 years. As a clinical social worker at Healthcare for the Homeless, she's devoted her attention to the plight of PLWHA. I'll let her explain that a little bit more. Ms. Williams is a fourth-year public health doctoral candidate at Morgan State University's School of Community Health and Policy, and her primary interest areas are in HIV epidemiology and social determinants of health.
Good evening. Good evening. My name is LaWanda Williams, and as you heard, I am a doctoral student at Morgan State University, and I'm also an employee of Healthcare for the Homeless in Baltimore City. I do need to say that I am employed by Healthcare for the Homeless, which in the course of my talk this evening, I'll talk about the fact that the program that we've utilized is a very interesting initiative that is a component of this agency, and I am a paid employee. So I'd like to start off with just some conversation about the outline here. We'll talk a little bit about the learning objectives that hopefully you will be able to benefit from and take back to your own settings. I'll start off with a little bit about the background of HIV, discuss some of the state and local epidemiology of HIV and homelessness, and talk about the synergy of HIV and homelessness. I'll also talk about the healthcare for the homeless response to what we were seeing in Baltimore with respect to these dual syndromes, and share some lessons learned and policy recommendations. So hopefully at the end of the talk, my hope is that you'll be able to describe the epidemiology of HIV and homelessness at the state and local levels, that you'll be able to explain the intersection between HIV and homelessness, discuss the Connect Project, which I will talk about in later slides, and its similarity to a patient-centered medical home model. And this is very important in terms of when you think about sustainability and with respect to resources and finances. Also, my hope is that you'll be able to compare the incidence of undetectable viral load between housed and homeless program participants, getting some understanding of some of the comorbid conditions that exist between HIV and homelessness, and also take back to your own settings at least one policy recommendation that will be transferable to where you are. So just a bit of background with respect to HIV and AIDS. So I would imagine it's hard to imagine that many people don't know about HIV and AIDS, but I will suffice it to say that it's still a pretty devastating pandemic that is affecting many people across the globe. And here in the United States, one of the largest growing populations that are disproportionately affected by HIV are the MSM population, so that is men sleeping with men. And they account for 61% of new cases in the United States. And despite a lot of the pharmaceutical advancements that have been made, persons living with HIV and AIDS are, you know, unable to realize optimal health and wellness, especially with respect to HIV viral load and being able to achieve better outcomes with respect to that. You know, and the second chart here talks a little bit about the fact that the black male population accounts for the largest section of new cases as well, and comprised within that population would definitely include some folks who would identify as men having sex with men. So in terms of state and local level HIV epidemiology, so the incidence in 2010, there were actually 1,708 new cases, which reflects a rate of 30 per 100,000. The prevalence in Maryland, there were not quite, a little bit over 29,000 people living with HIV and AIDS. which equates to 513 people per 100,000. Within Baltimore City, the incidents in 2010 were 951 new cases, and the prevalence in Baltimore City as of 2010 was a little over 18,000 cases of people living with HIV and AIDS. So this chart here gives a little bit of a schematic of the local distribution of homelessness in Baltimore City. So the homeless census count is something that is done in the city of Baltimore every 2 years, and it's a collaboration between the Office of Homeless Services and Morgan State University, and the most recent one was done in 2011. But this shows a little bit, in terms of percentages, about the characteristics of folks that were found to be homeless during a very, very, very cold night in January, where community partners, volunteers, recipients of services, governmental agencies all converged together from the hours of 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. to actually physically go into the streets and count folks who were homeless. And so this gives a sense of the things that we were finding with respect to the folks that we met. So 33.7% of them reported having substance abuse. 20% indicated that they had mental health issues, 10% described some level of chronic disease, and 3.7% discussed the fact that they were known to be HIV positive. So in this, as you will see, some of these characteristics are very much related to the population that we serve at Healthcare for the Homeless. So in terms of the intersection between HIV and homelessness, it really is a double burden sort of syndrome. So there is stigma related to the condition of homelessness. There's also stigma that is related to the condition of being HIV positive. And a lot of the risk factors and the stigmas that are related to each individually also are related to both sort of simultaneously. And really, this syndrome really does affect people's ability to access care. So in many terms, you know, we talk about access to care in terms of there being healthcare centers and there being a physical place. But the way in which HIV and homelessness affects people in terms of creating barriers to access to care sort of transcend the structural buildings oftentimes. So you can have a facility there, but because people are not able to access those services and navigate those services, they still don't have full access to care, even though the healthcare center, the building is structurally there. And there's an overlapping relationship between the actual risk factors for HIV and homelessness. So people living on the street or in shelters, you know, they are exposed to unhealthy living conditions that increase the potential for opportunistic infections. So people that are HIV positive obviously are very vulnerable to OIs. People that are living, you know, on the streets or in shelters are more prone to skin infections and all sorts of things that can exacerbate HIV, you know, HIV needs and other things that could be separately related to HIV. Also, the lack of housing prevents adequate medication storage. It negatively, in fact, impacts food security. And both of these key elements are requirements for optimal health outcomes. So many heart medications, medications that treat HIV, you know, they have to be taken with a certain amount of food, they have to be taken with a certain amount of grams of fat, that sort of thing. So when folks aren't able to have good food security, or they're getting the majority of their foods from other people on the street, from soup kitchens, things that are prepackaged, they may have more concentrations of sodium than anything that promotes health and wellness. So that's something to be mindful of. Also, the efforts to acquire shelter can actually involve the use of sex as a commodity, which obviously has important implications for HIV as well as safety and a host of other things. And then the overwhelming focus on survival in the moment and meeting basic needs can sort of diminish the ability to focus on more hierarchical activities. And when I say that, I mean, really being able to participate in care, access care, follow up on treatment recommendations that providers have, or even things like keeping medical appointments. And so housing instability adversely impacts HIV medication adherence, which is what we are extremely concerned about. And this is demonstrated in ways where transitions to new providers, it can cause disruptions in care. And then where people are living, they may not feel safe to disclose their status. So people may not be able to actually store their medications there because the environment in which they're staying, it's not safe for them to be HIV positive, or they don't perceive that it's safe for them to be HIV positive there. And so healthcare for the homeless had a very unique response to this, and seeing that there was a pretty significant deficit in services at the program's inception, which was almost 10 years ago, devised a program called Connect Project. And it's the premise of the program, really, it's founded in response to the lack of services in terms of intensive case management for people that are homeless and living with HIV. And it really has the undergirding principle that we're starting where the client is, and that this belief will positively influence HIV-related health outcomes. And when we say starting where the client is, it really is a dual saying. So we start where the client is in terms of, like, actually where they are. So the people in the program, we go out to shelters, we will meet them at doctor's appointments, we'll meet them at McDonald's to provide the services that we have. So there's really no place that we will not venture to try to reach folks. And then more from a theological standpoint, starting where the client is in terms of understanding that everyone is not going to be at a place where they feel they're ready to engage services, that they're ready to completely abandon adverse health behaviors, and so really taking different approaches to try to engage people in care and to motivate people to make positive health changes. And so the program goals were to alleviate the incidence and burdens of homelessness among people living with HIV and AIDS, and to improve HIV-related health outcomes by reducing HIV viral load, and to increase medication adherence and retention in care. So the targeted populations for this particular program, so folks have to be HIV positive, they must also have a co-occurring mental health or substance use disorder, they must be Baltimore City residents, be at least 18 years of age or older, they have to be referred from a service provider, and that could be their physician, a social service agency, a therapist, case manager, and they can be currently homeless, unstably housed, or at risk of homelessness. And so some of the basic participant characteristics, so the majority of folks who are in the program are between the ages of 31 and 50, and they represent about 50% of the population. Folks who are 51 and over represent about 40%, with the remaining percent represented by the 18 to 30 category. Our program, in terms of sex at birth, it's pretty evenly distributed between male and female. So with respect to race, probably not so surprising if people know anything about Baltimore City, but it is a city that is predominantly African American, so it's not surprising or alarming to see that there are a pretty significant amount of African Americans represented by the program. And they represent 90% of the program participants. So some of the social economical characteristics among clients. So 69% of the participants are living on $710 a month or less, which is what standardized SSI payments are. So the majority of clients are receiving SSI income at $710 or less per month. And almost half of the participants lacked high school education or GED. And as well, about half of the participants had a limited, very limited, or a chaotic support system. So one thing to mention, though, is despite this, you know, and many times we look at these sort of this data and we think about it from a deficiency or a dysfunctional place, you know, I think it's important to recognize the fact that, you know, the clients in the program are extremely resilient, you know, despite these challenges, despite having very limited incomes, they have really been able to make the most of their limited resources, and they've been able to stay alive, you know, despite this, despite having such challenges, maybe not having the optimal care and being able to navigate care because of health, you know, low health literacy and other things. They have been tremendously resilient and able to make accommodations as they've needed to. So some of the comorbid conditions that we see with our clients, And they really complicate or are complicated by having HIV and also being homeless, where diabetes in particular. A vast majority of the clients also have diabetes on top of the other challenges, health challenges that they face. And really, you know, having diabetes in the context of HIV and homelessness is pretty devastating in that it impacts your ability to properly store your insulin. You know, there's potential of frostbite and skin infections from living on the streets, and then also inadequate nutrition and foods, you know, food insecurity. Things like hypertension are adversely affected by being HIV positive. Some of the medications that are used to treat some of the ARTs actually can cause down the road cardiovascular difficulties, so that's something to consider. And then also, too, with being homeless, just the reliance on very cheap foods, which tend to be full of preservatives and high sodium and all of that. So it's challenging to have hypertension in the context of these things. Also, chronic pain and how that decreases mobility, your ability to get into a clinic when you do want to access services. And then also the role that trauma plays. And we look at that as a comorbid condition because it really can impact the patient-provider relationship, which we know is a pretty significant indicator of people's engagement in care, and then also can influence treatment adherence. So the program framework of the Connect Project is a team-based approach to care where there is a central case manager who sort of serves as what you would see as a medical provider on a medical model care team. There's also a nurse case manager who will assist with helping people get connected to more of the concentrated medical pieces of what they need to manage their care. Very central to this care team is the patient advocate, and that person's role really is to help people negotiate healthcare systems. So they will do that by physically escorting clients to appointments. They will help to sort of interpret information that's being provided from the medical provider to the client, and helping to translate what the client is saying to the medical provider. So this is a very intricate role and essential to making the team work. And then it's also important to mention that under this project, we also look at the client as part of that care team. So we're engaging the client around, you know, what is it that they see in terms of their health goals, and eliciting feedback from them in terms of what they'd like to see with their care. And that the major benefits from this is that you have multiple partners that you're collaborating with that bring a certain level of expertise to the team, and then just the additional benefits of care coordination. And I think the important part of this, when we think about it from a patient-centered medical home perspective, is that there are the teams are set up similarly, so you would have a medical provider who is sort of the point person who's negotiating you know, referrals and that sort of thing, and coordinating the care. And on those teams, there are typically a medical provider, there's usually a nurse, there's usually a medical assistant who will also, from the patient-centered medical care perspective, help to coordinate services for the client. And then the primary care provider actually assumes ownership for care coordination. The thinking about these two things similarly will have really important implications for sustainability over time. And then the clinical frameworks that we utilize are harm reduction, the stages of change model, and trauma-informed care from a clinical perspective. And from programming, we look at harm reduction and also the trans-theoretical model and the way that we develop the program. Some of the services that we provide are intensive case management, so helping people access housing, public benefits, and helping to support their medication adherence. We also provide supportive counseling, care coordination, and then we also do community-based visits. So some of the lessons that we've learned are that, you know, housing is healthcare, and that we really have seen our clients be able to attain undetectable viral loads when they had not been able to before. So as you'll see here, we use the 75 as a measure of undetectable viral load. And there were 26 people out of 48 in this particular population of participants who had undetectable viral load. And as you'll see, the overwhelming majority of those folks had, were housed. So 92% of our patients who are housed have undetectable viral loads, which is phenomenal, where they had not previously. And then we really learned that partnerships work, that building relationships with transitional housing programs, building relationships with subsidized housing programs like the Hopper program and HIP voucher programs, reentry voucher programs, really give us the additional support that we need to best address the holistic needs of our participants. And then access the financial resources that remove housing barriers, so people being able to resolve past due BG&E bills so they can get electricity turned on in their homes, security deposit assistance with first month's rent. And so some of the recommendations that we've come with as a result of this work is just the paradigm shift from housing readiness models to models around housing first, that people don't need to get ready for housing. People are ready for housing, and that by putting them in housing, that helps to alleviate some of the other burdens that improve health outcomes, specifically HIV viral load. Medicaid expansion, this is something that we're working tirelessly on, and I will be ecstatic, if we are able to convince Medicaid to pay for permanent supportive housing. That's a dream of mine that I have quite often, and so, I think that there is a lot of research that's speaking to the fact that the high utilizers of ED services and specialized care, a lot of that cost could be averted if we were providing structural interventions on the front end and taking a more preventative approach. And also transferring savings from mortgage interest reduction, transferring that to the National Housing Trust Fund. People use those incomes to pay for their security deposits, oftentimes the child tax credit and things of that sort. And then also giving additional training and support to stakeholders and providers. And lastly, I just want to mention, just in programming, I would encourage folks to consider the way in which class and poverty impacts the work that they do with marginalized populations, and not just from a direct practice standpoint, but really from a public health standpoint, what that looks like and how you how you develop your policies and your programming. So I want to say thank you. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak this evening.
All right, yeah, that was great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.